Did an Evendale police officer lead a van of armed neo-Nazis to pull over near a school parking lot? Lachlan's school board is calling for an independent investigation into what transpired last week. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, we're going to talk about the fallout since last week's neo-Nazi demonstration over I-75. And should the Bengals sell Bitcoin to pay for their stadium? Plus, we'll learn more about Cincinnati's new archbishop. We have a lot to discuss. Joining me now to get us started, our WCPO 9 news reporter, Jay Shakur. Thanks for being here, Jay.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah, and WVXU general assignment and long-form reporter, Nick Swartzel. Welcome back, Nick.
Hey, Lucy.
Nick, more information's come to light this week about that neo-Nazi demonstration that occurred last Friday, February 7th, on this I-75 overpass. Explain briefly what happened last Friday.
Yeah, so a lot of people have probably seen something about this or heard about this or read the great coverage that WCPO and WVXU and other outlets have done. So Friday afternoon, about 2, a group of about a dozen people who were dressed all in black with face masks, bearing swastikas and flags, and some of them had assault rifles as well, took positions on the Vision Way Bridge between Lincoln Heights and Evendale. And they were there for not very long before some folks started coming from the west, many of them residents of Lincoln Heights, to confront this hate group. At roughly the same time, law enforcement, both Hamilton County Sheriff and Evendale Police, were coming to kind of intervene in the situation because, as law enforcement said, it got pretty tense. Social media video shows the Nazis, throwing out racial epithets and things like that. And eventually they were convinced to leave, not before things got pretty tense.
Yeah. Well, and I know, Nick, Hamilton County commissioners raised some questions this week about that law enforcement response. What concerns have commissioners raised about how the police reacted?
Basically that the reaction from law enforcement was pretty hasty. Like Evendale issued a response very quickly, pointing out there was no law broken or anything like that. There was also, I think, some just criticism about the response being a little lenient toward the neo-Nazi protesters. And that's the community. Lincoln Heights has a lot of questions as well about that.
Yeah. Well, and Jay, residents of Lincoln Heights, as Nick just said, have really expressed frustration. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about their concerns.
Yeah, definitely. The biggest thing coming out of post last Friday, a week ago today, was that police response. So much video, as you mentioned, circulating across social media. Residents had legitimate concerns about, not only leniency, but, the knowledge of this type of protest happening at this particular spot. So yeah, residents concerned about that. Very angry, upset, given the history of Lincoln Heights, being a historically black village, the first self-governing village north of the Mason-Dixon line. So they were concerned about the role that police played, one resident told me, and also more so about, that leniency and response. Mm-hmm. Why weren't there wasn't some type of charge or something like that?
Yeah. Hamilton County Sheriff Charmaine McGuffey talked about police response.
When officers arrive on a scene where you have, and I'm just going to say it, ugly, ugly individuals standing there with a weapon, all right, strapped to them, and it's a weapon that can cause a lot of damage and kill people, their goal is to de-escalate that. They had to keep the residents from approaching those individuals and possibly being shot or shot at.
Jay, where was the sheriff talking about this?
This was at a meeting held, town hall rather, held in the village of Lincoln Heights at the village hall. This was Monday when she came and answered all questions, listened to the residents' concerns there. Got pretty intense and heated in that room. The balancing the fine line between free speech and inciting violence and hateful rhetoric was really the conversation there. One resident asked me, when does free speech go too far? In this sense of having these neo-Nazis show up, brandishing weapons, and throwing out racial slurs? When does that go too far into inciting fear and violence? So that was Monday, really forthcoming and answering and taking, you know, directly head on those questions from concerned residents.
Yeah. Nick, the Laughlin Local School District Board of Education recently released video footage of a police car and the neo-Nazis near school grounds in Laughlin. Tell us about what happened there.
Yeah, so this came out just a couple of days ago. The school district issued this statement saying, we have video footage, security footage of the Evendale police cruiser coming in first, and then right behind it, the U-Haul that the Nazis were driving and riding in. After the event happened, there are questions about like what was going on there, what happened. After a few minutes, the officer gets out of the cruiser, talks to the occupants of the U-Haul, and then drives off. The U-Haul then goes onto school property, the parking lot, and then takes off as well. We don't know exactly what was happening there. Evendale has said they were trying to get the Nazis away from the scene. And there was some discussion about going back and getting a Jeep and things like that. But, you know, there's still more questions to be answered there.
Yeah. And that was right about the time school was about to dismiss, I think, right?
Yeah. According to the superintendent, within a few minutes of the elementary school being let out.
Jay, you talked with Laughlin Superintendent Bob Longworth.
I don't think I can appropriately put to words how heartbreaking it is to know that there are students every day now that dismiss from both of our schools and walk home through our community and have reason to question their safety.
He sounds pretty shaken up by this whole thing.
He was. You could hear the emotion a bit in his voice there. And that was one of the lesser emotional parts of the conversation and him talking to the media. There was a genuine sense of fear. The big question that lingered beyond, you know, police response was, will they come back? That was the big question. And he talked about how students were concerned walking to school and walking home, you know, is it okay for me to go home? You had kids the following Monday, you know, fearful to go to school. And thank God, particularly in Lincoln Heights, they welcomed their students back, you know, with a big show of parents and adults showing up and welcoming them back. But there was a real sense of, you know, why now? And then will you all come back?
Especially since they had these weapons.
Yeah.
A number of them did. Nick, now the board's calling for an independent investigation. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So the superintendent and the board have asked for more answers about kind of what was going on, why the Evendale police officer chose that spot specifically, why the neo-Nazis were briefly on school property, and basically want to know, you know, what's the plan if something like this were to happen again.
Have we gotten much response from Laughlin and Evendale law enforcement authorities about that, what they're saying about what happened at this near the school?
I reached out to Evendale after this this release from the school district, kind of asking sort of a response. They said their law department is working on a response. I haven't gotten that yet, but other media outlets might have been more successful.
Yeah. Did you hear from them?
Didn't hear from Evendale, but from Laughlin. I talked to the chief yesterday, and he made it clear that Laughlin police, beyond the neo-Nazi group being escorted away from the bridge, Laughlin police had no involvement. He has said that he's in coordination with Evendale, but obviously that's on Evendale's side to speak for themselves. But he's made it clear that Laughlin police, beyond that that overpass, there was no contact with the neo-Nazis.
One thing to add, too, about kind of Laughlin School District's questions is they want to know why they weren't notified that this was happening. I think that's important to mention as well.
Yeah, notified that this group was going to be near their school property, especially since they were armed.
Yeah.
Jay, now a group of masked armed men spent time patrolling the streets of Lincoln Heights in response to the neo-Nazis. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was almost an instant reaction starting, going from last Friday going into that Monday of Lincoln Heights residents taking their weapons and standing on corners throughout the village, not a big village, but throughout the village, armed around the clock from, you know, sun up to sundown and even beyond that, just standing guard, not sure what would happen, not sure if the group would come back. And it was a show of force in the sense that they were saying, this is our community. That type of rhetoric Those type of displays aren't welcomed here, and we're going to do what we can to protect ourselves. And I think it's interesting, you asked in talking to some of them, none of them wanted to talk directly to us, at least on camera, but they did speak off camera. And a lot of it was, you know, we're questioning the role of police right now. We don't feel safe. We feel violated, and we're going to protect, you know, our people. And literally, they use the term, we're taking shifts in terms of protecting and standing what they standing guard as they believe.
Yeah. I know they gave a local pastor permission to speak for them.
What became clear yesterday was that there has been a pretty significant deterioration in the relationship of the sheriff to the community. That's why people feel they don't trust the policing, the law enforcement that exists in the community.
Really echoing that sentiment that you just said you heard from some of the people on this patrol off camera. I mean, is this based on that lack of trust that, hey, we better take this into our own hands in case these people come back?
For sure, it is. You know, Lincoln Heights at one point had its own police department, and now it's has this contract with the Hamilton County Sheriff's, and a lot of residents are saying, hey, you have this contract, you're getting tax dollars from us to secure us, and we don't feel that that was done sufficiently last Friday. We want, you know, more done on the daily front, but also more done when these type of heightened situations occur. So definitely, you know, came from that sentiment of not trusting law enforcement in this particular instance.
Yeah. You also heard from someone concerned about the patrols.
As soon as we got off the exit at the first stop sign, we were met with, you know, groups and groups of people putting on bulletproof vests, holding guns, and just linked up. And they had walkie-talkies and stuff, but nobody in a uniform.
Tell us a little bit about that gentleman we just heard from.
Yeah, he's a contractor that does contract work in the area for a property that's in Lincoln Heights. He doesn't live in Lincoln Heights himself, but he does work there. And he says he was going about his daily, you know, going to work to service, prepare. I believe we have snow the next day to prepare, you know, salt the grounds and everything for that snow. And he was stopped. And it I think is a powerful testament of what fear does. It, you know, whether or not, you know, we can only you can go about his account of the incident, but whether or not the incident is exactly as he described, there was this palpable sense of fear on both sides. Him being approached by these people and the residents in Lincoln Heights being there protecting themselves, not sure who this outside person is given the recent incidents. And so that heightened sense of fear was really reflected in that interaction. Thank God, you know, nothing violent happened. But that, you know, that shows you, although no violence has occurred, you know, kind of the tipping point this community is on, not knowing, you know, a quote unquote outsiders coming in, what they really want.
Yeah.
Really, really scary situation.
You also spoke with State Representative Cecil Thomas. What did he tell you about what the state's doing, what he thinks the state should be doing?
He believes there are laws already on the books that can be enforced and in terms of surrounding inciting violence and speech that incite violence and displays that incite violence. And so he told me that he's working with the state's public safety director to put out what he calls a training memo to clarify for local law enforcement officers, particularly those smaller municipalities and jurisdictions, about how they can go about enforcing that and what they can and can't do. He felt that that was very unclear. He felt that some of the actions taken by law enforcement reflected the fact that it needed more clarity. He doesn't think necessarily on a state level more law needs to be passed. He feels it's already on the books. He cites, you know, his experience as a police officer, as well as, you know, being a lawmaker now, that there's clarity that's needed. And so that should, he says that should be coming out pretty soon. They're working to get that out as a training memo. Yeah.
Nick, I understand there's a demonstration planned for this weekend. What can you tell us about that?
So there's a protest Sunday at Washington Park. There will probably be elements of anti-Nazi sort of a demonstration at that, but it is also aimed at some Trump administration policies, specifically around immigration. So not just a response to what happened on the bridge between Evendale and Lincoln Heights, but there will certainly be some of that there, I'm sure.
Sure. Well, Nick, I want to ask you, too. This happened outside the Cincinnati city limits, but Cincinnati Mayor Aftab Purival told our colleague Becca Costello that he's exploring ordinances for Cincinnati in response to what happened last Friday. Tell us just a little bit about some of the approaches he's considering.
Yeah, Becca had a story about this. One of the things that they're researching, and this is kind of early days on this, but an ordinance that would ban wearing a mask while open carrying. They're also looking at other cities that have dealt with more extensive sort of Nazi protests like Nashville to kind of see what they do. But the early days on this, they haven't really put anything forward yet. They're also going to have to keep in mind the state law about gun regulations and how that has played with city ordinances in the past.
Sure. What's legal for them to do?
Exactly.
Well, Nick, I want to switch gears just a little bit and talk to you about Vision and Beyond. You've talked before on this program about all the complicated lawsuits and court filings related to this company. Tell us a little bit about that to set it up for people, but also you got to talk to some residents recently. Tell us what they're experiencing.
Yeah, so I've been reporting on this for a little over a month now. There's some really complicated legal battles going on over Vision and Beyond, which is a property investment group, or was a property investment group that invested in over 70 rental properties in Cincinnati, some large apartment complexes, some smaller houses. The initial reporting I did was on that legal battle, and I did talk to some residents then. Many were not willing to go on the record at that point because things were up in the air. Things are still up in the air, but people are just like getting really fed up. So some of the things that residents are facing across the city, and we're talking like 600 or more units of housing. So, you know, at least that number of people probably. We're talking about in some places ceilings that have fallen in a month ago that haven't been repaired. We're talking about people going without heat for a couple weeks because they're not sure who their property manager is, or there's been some kind of weird transition. One complex, everyone got blanket eviction notices for saying they owe $2,000 or $3,000 in rent when that wasn't necessarily the case, they say. And then not knowing who put those eviction notices up, and there's only an email address that doesn't respond to you when you try to. So, you know, these notices saying you got to be out in 3 days, and nobody knows who left them there. So that's kind of the situation. It's ongoing at this point. But there might be some help coming soon.
Yeah. So who can these renters call if something goes wrong with their house, like the heat goes out or there's, you know, a big water leak and the ceiling falls through? Who can they call if it's so unclear who's managing these apartments and rental homes?
Well, the answer is they can't call their property manager in some cases because there just isn't one. But that could change soon. And also they can call legal aid if you Google Greater Cincinnati Legal Aid. They have an intake number. They're working with residents right now to advocate for them in the court.
Yeah. Well, I would encourage our listeners to check out your coverage on WVXU.org. There's a whole lot more there, and I hope we can talk more about this in the future. I've been talking with WCPO9 news reporter Jay Shakur and WVXU reporter Nick Swartzel. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Lucy.
Up next, would you ever consider buying Bengals Bitcoin? This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Would you ever consider buying Bengals Bitcoin? It could be a thing someday. Joining me now to explain the concept and what it would mean for fans and the team is WCPO9 I-Team reporter Dan Monk. Welcome back, Dan.
Hi, Lucy. Thanks for having me.
Always great to have you on the program. Explain this concept of turning the Cincinnati Bengals into a digitally owned asset.
Well, first of all, I should point out that I learned about this by listening to your show.
Oh, Dan, you sweet talker. And it's Valentine's Day. Thanks, Dan.
You're welcome. Last fall, you interviewed Adam Kaler, who was running for Hamilton County Commission, and he talked about this idea as a way to gain leverage in the Bengals stadium talks. And so when I started covering the Bengals again after a long absence this year, this was one of the things that I listened to. And the idea just kind of intrigued me. What he's talking about is what they call tokenizing the team. That means converting it into a digital asset that can be split into thousands, millions of pieces, and then bought and sold and traded like Bitcoin is traded today. And in his opinion, Kaler's opinion, this deal could generate billions of dollars in cash for the family of Bengals owner Mike Brown and still keep them in control of the franchise that was founded by NFL legend Paul Brown in 1967.
Now, I am going to sound probably even older than I actually am right now when I ask this, but if this were to happen, what would people who buy these tokens actually own? I mean, is this like shareholders who own stock certificates in a company?
I think it would be similar to the Green Bay Packers owning, being owned by the citizens of Green Bay. They don't really have any control over the future of the team, any decision-making power. They just own shares in this corporation that is, you can buy and sell shares within it, but it's not the same as a publicly traded company where they have to report to you all the things they're doing, and you have some influence over how the board votes on key matters. So I think it would largely be a ceremonial purchase that would increase or decrease in value based on NFL valuations. And we all know that NFL valuations have been going up, up, and up over the last 20 years. And so, you know, in Kaler's view, if you bought into this thing, it would be kind of like a point of civic pride, I guess. I own a piece of the Bengals. And if it keeps going up and up, and at someday you could sell that to the other owners of this digital asset, you know, there would be a limited market for you to cash in on that investment if you were to cash out.
Well, and as you mentioned, Adam Kaler first started talking about this when he was a candidate for Hamilton County Commission. Talk a little bit more about why he thinks this would be good for taxpayers. Is there more to it than civic pride?
Yeah, one of the reasons I was interested in this story is because he is saying a lot of the things that I've heard from business leaders in Cincinnati and just kind of Bengals fans generally who really follow the business of the Bengals. And one of the concerns that people have about the team is that it's owned by one family that derives almost all of their wealth from the team itself. The team is worth $4.1 billion. The Bengals own like 97% of the shares. And just last year, Mike Brown made it to the Forbes 400 list. He and his family are worth $3.9 billion, according to Forbes. But it's all wealth that's tied up in the team. And so the thinking is, do the Bengals have enough cash to compete with other NFL teams, which are often owned by some of the richest people in the country? So a lot of billionaires own teams. In a lot of cases, the ownership group is deeper than one family or one super majority owner. And so the thinking is that those other teams have more ability to do things like long-term contracts, where if you, in the NFL, if you guarantee somebody payments in year five of a contract, you have to put that money in escrow. And that's something that the Bengals have been reluctant to do in the past because it's putting cash to play into play that you really don't benefit from for, you know, 5 years. Some people think that the Bengals might have trouble passing ownership from one generation to the next. So all of these ideas are problems that Kaler thinks the Bengals could solve by being more liquid. In other words, if they sold some small percentage, anywhere from 10 to 49%, they could stay in control, but they could generate cash from the sale of these digital assets.
So that's his argument for why it would be good for the Brown family who owns the team.
Yeah.
It's that, hey, they'd have more liquidity, more cash they could do stuff with.
That's his theory, yes.
Okay. Well, I know you talked with some sports business experts about this idea, too. What did Joe Cobbs of Northern Kentucky University tell you? Does he think the Brown family would be interested in this?
He doesn't think the Brown family would be interested, and I think most people would have to agree with him. He said they're not known to be early adopters. And in fact, the NFL last year changed the rules so that private equity firms could buy up to 10% of NFL teams. And some owners were taking advantage of this and pushing for this rule change for the same reasons we're talking about. They want a cash infusion. They don't want to give up control of the team. And so they wanted to change the rules to allow private equity firms to make a purchase of a minority stake. Well, the Bengals were the only NFL team that voted against that. So that is a sign that they're not interested in selling.
Well, Adam Kaler's not the only person you interviewed who thinks this idea has merit, though. Who's Mike Hiles and what's his take on the whole thing?
Mike is somebody who has tokenized real-world assets and advises companies on how to do it. I think he did one of the first deals where a real estate asset was tokenized. And, you know, basically what he says is that there is reason to believe that this could happen, particularly because we've just changed presidential administrations, and President Donald Trump is a huge proponent of cyber currency. He wants the U.S. to be the cyber capital of the world. And he has talked about things like giving tax breaks on capital gains within these digital asset investment vehicles. And so, I mean, that in theory, that could be another advantage for the Bengals and a way for them to trade some of their family assets to future generations and then not have to pay capital gains taxes on the sale. So for that and a number of other reasons, this guy thinks that digital assets is the kind of the wave of the future, and that in the future, a lot of assets will be traded this way. So far, that really hasn't happened, but that's partly because the government agencies, the SEC in particular, has been very skeptical of these kinds of deals. And he sees that changing in the next 4 years under Trump.
Well, we've all heard about some of the bad stuff that's happened with some of these digital companies and CEOs. Is there any worry that something like this could result in a rug pull kind of scheme that's so prevalent in so-called meme coins?
Well, this is a little different than a meme coin because a meme coin has no inherent value. It's worth whatever anybody, you know, if you want to be cool and own one, you'll buy it, and the day it stops being cool, it's worth nothing. So in this case, you're talking about tying a digital asset to a real world asset, which has inherent value. So, I think some of the problems that are inherent in this kind of transaction is maybe the lack of disclosure or the lack of control for investors. If investors buy a coin and they find out and they don't like how the team is performing, they can sell it to other investors, but they have no ability to influence the operation of the business. And so, what is a team worth? How will those values change over time? You know, if you buy in, you're not guaranteed to make money. There are people who could buy in and lose big money. And there's really no mechanism in place for these kinds of investments where details are shared. Like if you bought the Bengals shares through one of these digital vehicles, they're not obligated to tell you their financial information or how they're spending their money or whether they're risking your future on, investments that are bound to lose money. And I think that's where a lot of the regulators or the critics of these kinds of deals have pointed to problems in that they behave kind of like a publicly traded company, but you don't have the same access to information as somebody who owns a publicly traded company.
What role, theoretically, could this whole concept play in the stadium lease negotiations?
Well, this is another theory that Adam Kaler voiced. You know, there is a rule called the Art Modell Law in Ohio. When Art Modell took his team from Cleveland and moved them to Baltimore, state lawmakers passed this law that said if you're in a taxpayer-subsidized stadium, You basically have to make the team available to local investors before you move it to another city. And Adam kind of came up with this idea as a way to gain leverage, because he thought that if the Bengals decided to leave town or threatened to leave town, they might be able to trigger the Art Modell rule to force a sale of the team. And if you had this digital asset in place, that's a ready buyer that could be pointed to as saying, hey, we've raised $5 billion and we want to buy the team. And so, you know, in his way of thinking, this is a way for taxpayers to have some leverage against the team in stadium talks. It removes the or it lessens the risk of them threatening to leave town and leaving us empty handed without an NFL team. You'd have a ready buyer in place. And in theory, if they tried to leave town, you could exercise the Art Modell rule to block them by buying the team from them.
And would this in any way generate a pile of cash that could be used to help with the cost of stadium renovations, or is that crazy talk?
No, I mean, if this were to happen, and again, not likely, but if this were to happen, let's say they sold, if the team's worth $4.1 billion and they sold a 49% chunk of it, that's $2 billion. So you could use that money for contracts. You could use it for stadiums. You could use it to, they could use it to buy the real estate that Hamilton County has acquired on their behalf and develop it themselves. They could be real estate developers. I mean, there's anything, you know, any, once they get the cash, it's up to them how they want to spend it. And so in theory, if they were to be convinced to cash out in this way, they could pay for the entirety of the stadium renovations that they want.
Wow. Did the Bengals talk with you about this? Any response from the team to this whole idea?
No, no response. No, they didn't want to talk about it.
Huh. And I know you tried. You tried to get them to talk
about
it. Well,
I did hear from some back channels that this is something they are not going to be interested in. And I've heard, you know, from others that the team has no shortage of cash. They have an asset that's worth $4 billion. They could always borrow against it. And so, you know, the idea that the Bengals are cash poor and house rich, I don't think is entirely true. And so they really have no motivation to sell or to do any of these things. But it's still interesting to think about, because, you know, it's a problem that the region has to confront, and here's a potential solution.
Yeah. Have any of the current county commissioners expressed any opinions on this?
No, I think the closest that they've come to it is Alicia Reese pointing out that Mike Brown made the Forbes 400 list. And, you know, she, in the most recent meeting where the commissioners discussed this, she talked about how obviously this lease is profitable for Mike Brown because, you know, he's worth $3.9 billion according to Forbes. And so, and then she also in the same meeting said, it's time for us to get a better lease deal from the Bengals. And so that's kind of the closest that anybody's come to it. There's a desire for the Bengals to pay more in this round of stadium talks than they did in the late 90s when they signed the lease for Paycor Stadium.
And I know we are all following those negotiations as closely as we can. I've been talking with WCPO9 iTeam reporter Dan Monk. Thanks so much for your time today, Dan. I hope you have a great weekend.
You too. Thanks.
Up next, we'll learn more about Cincinnati's new archbishop. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Pope Francis had big news for Greater Cincinnati Catholics this week. The Pope accepted the resignation of Cincinnati Archbishop Dennis Schnur and named a successor. Joining me in this recorded interview to talk about the new archbishop and the challenges he faces is Cincinnati Inquirer investigative reporter Dan Horn. Welcome back, Dan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So the Cincinnati Archdiocese has a new archbishop. Explain what happened Wednesday.
So the current Archbishop Dennis Schnur was required to submit his resignation last year when he turned 75 years old. That's the age limit for bishops. They can stay on longer and often do, but the Pope on Wednesday accepted his resignation formally and appointed Robert G. Casey, who is currently the auxiliary bishop in Chicago, to be his successor here in Cincinnati.
How long has Dennis Schnur been the archbishop here in Cincinnati?
About 16 years. He came here 16 and a half, 17 years ago, and he was the auxiliary bishop here initially alongside Daniel Pilarczyk. And he replaced Pilarczyk about a year later. And so he's been here almost 16 years. It's probably just shy of that. Hmm. So, yeah, he came from Iowa where he was a bishop there. He was pretty prominent in the church, in the American church, and had several prominent roles with the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops and ended up serving about a decade and a half here before stepping down.
Okay. You mentioned Robert Casey will be the new archbishop. Tell us about him.
Well, he's 57, which is kind of young by bishop standards in the United States.
Dan, I'm 57. I think it's young by any standards, but please do go on. Yeah.
I think he's about 6 months younger than me, which is just terrifying to me in a lot of ways. But he is a youngish bishop. He has served his entire career in Chicago and Chicago area. He grew up there. He said that he was a high school student, not really thinking about the priesthood, and interviewed a priest when he was a senior for a class project. And at the end of the interview, the priest asked him, "Have you ever thought about the priesthood?" And he said, "Nope." Then he started thinking about it and went in seminary, and the rest is history. He served as a parish priest in the Chicago area for about 20 years. He is fluent in Spanish and was very involved in Hispanic ministry in Chicago. I think he founded a group or two that was dedicated to helping immigrants and minority communities. And so he then became an auxiliary bishop in 2018. In Chicago.
Now, he faced an allegation in 2008 of misconduct with a child. What can you tell us about that?
Well, what we know about it was that it occurred in 2008. The complaint was filed in 2008 with Illinois Family and Children's Services. He was suspended for about 4 weeks from ministry while they investigated. They and church officials investigated on their own, and Family and Children's Services concluded after about 4 weeks that the allegation was unfounded. He was then reinstated. And as far as we know, there has not been another complaint since then. Now, that information was not immediately known in 2008. It wasn't made public until 2018, right before he was ordained as an auxiliary bishop in Chicago. At that point, the church disclosed that there had been this investigation and brief suspension back in 2008, and that's how we know about it now. But we don't know much more than that. He would not discuss it further, but he did give me a statement saying that, you know, the allegation was false, that he understands that as a consequence of that false allegation, he said that he will have, quote, an asterisk next to my name for the rest of my life. He said that, that's something that he will carry throughout the rest of his career. But he does maintain that that was a false allegation. The authorities who investigated concluded it was unfounded. And he went on to become a bishop not once, but now twice.
And now the authorities who investigated, just to make sure I'm clear, were those church authorities, were police or anything like that involved? Do we know anything about that?
These were state authorities investigated. I don't know the detail of the allegation itself, but from the looks of the order of events that occurred in 2008, it appears a complaint was made either directly to Illinois Family and Children's Services or to the church, and then was turned over to Illinois and Family and Children's Services. They were the ones who investigated, so state officials handled the investigation.
Okay.
It was not done just by the church.
Okay, good to know. Thank you. Did this new archbishop, did he have anything else to say about the problems the church has faced with sexual abuse?
He did. He talked a bit about the continuing need to, you know, maintain measures that are designed to keep children safe, including the, you know, the child protection decree in Cincinnati that's been in place now for a couple of decades. His main message was we have to be vigilant. We have to continue to make the changes that we made and stick to them. He said he believes the church is now a model for how others can build protection programs for kids. But he said that, you know, that could go away if the church doesn't stay vigilant. So it, essentially his message was we made progress, but we have to keep at it.
Describe the challenges the Cincinnati Archdiocese is facing that this new archbishop will inherit.
Probably the biggest is a massive reorganization that began just a couple years ago. It's called Beacons of Light. It is a restructuring, probably the largest restructuring in the history of the Archdiocese, which is more than 200 years old. That restructuring involves consolidating more than 200 parishes into 60 so-called families of parishes that will begin to share resources, buildings, schools, priests, sports teams, the whole shebang. A lot of that process is begun. It's not clear exactly where a lot of it's going. There will likely be school closings and parish closings connected to this consolidation, this restructuring. It's not yet clear how many there will be, but the ultimate goal is to basically make the 200 parishes that currently exist into 60 consolidated parishes. There will still be more churches than that, but as far as, you know, parish groupings and priests, you will have a reductions to save money, to save resources, and to deal with the shortage of priests that they've been experiencing for years.
Does this new Archbishop Robert Casey, does he seem committed to continuing on that path?
He does. Chicago is going through a similar process, and many dioceses are doing similar processes. Cleveland has undergone a similar process. They're all in various stages of development, but he has dealt with that in Chicago and says he is committed to dealing with it here.
You told us a little bit about this new archbishop. How did he introduce himself to the region this week?
Well, he came to town essentially for a press conference yesterday. He will be back and forth, I think, for a little while before he settles in, at which time he has promised to make himself available to the public, to priests, to lay Catholics, to the media, to talk about any questions they might have about where things are going within the diocese and, you know, the way he approaches the job. So he's promised to be transparent. He's promised to be open, and he's promised to be available. He also was asked some questions about immigration, diversity, the LGBTQ community. Obviously, those issues have been controversial within the church and around the country for several years. And he, you know, he didn't dive deep into those issues, but he also didn't just give a short answer. He talked a lot about, you know, being a welcoming church, trying to, I think his quote was, building bridges, not walls. So he did take some time to address some of those issues, although not in a whole lot of detail.
This idea of bridge builders, not wall builders, what did you make of that? Was that a political statement? The build a wall is something we've all heard in other contexts.
Yeah. He didn't go there beyond that, but, you know, you can read it how you want to read it. He steered clear of politics when he was pressed on some of those kinds of issues related to immigration, what he would do if ICE came to the door, that kind of thing. But he, you know, he made a point of being open about that issue in a way that I think some American bishops have not been. What that means, and whether that means this diocese will be any different in the way it deals with some of these issues or not, I can't say. I'm not sure anyone can at this point. Church doctrine is what it is, and the bishops have their guidance. And so, you know, there are limitations to what any bishop can do in terms of, you know, addressing some of these issues. But he did talk about it, and he talked about the need to be a welcoming church and a welcoming place.
How soon is he likely to begin his work here?
Pretty soon. You know, Archbishop Schnur, unfortunately, has been very ill. He had undergone small bowel cancer treatments last year. He had a fall and unfortunately had back surgery very recently. He is back home, but he was not able to attend the press conference yesterday. So I think Schnur is going to be available to help him, he has indicated, but Casey will be on the job pretty quickly.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with Cincinnati Enquirer investigative reporter Dan Horn. Thanks so much for your time today, Dan.
Great. Thank you, Lucy.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you have a great weekend.